Say sup, douchebags. These are two Limp Bizkit fans we love. The tambourine man has put his tambourine up my ass, up to my chest, and is jingly jangly.
To the Neutral Cider Hotel. My name is Gabe Cook. I'm the ciderologist and I'm your duty manager for this evening. The Neutral Cider Hotel is your comfortable and COVID-free bubble of lovely cideriness. And rest assured, here at the hotel, we're operating for full COVID standards. We've even washed the sheets in cider vinegar and we're all wearing face masks, but that's mostly to hide our grotesque features. But joining me this evening on the night shift is that guy that always comes into the bar and you have to ID him, even if he is 30 years old. It's Mr. Martin Goodwin Sharman. Hello, my friend. What have you been up to today?
Well, I've actually been doing a lovely cider thing. I was invited down again by Pilton to do a blend specifically for their 10th anniversary. So something a bit different from their usual Kieved sweet ciders. But basically just hanging out, drinking cider and making good cider.
Hooray. That's about as good as it gets right now, isn't it? Tough times, everybody.
Oh, yes.
Thank you, Martin. And finalizing our triumvirate of triumph, it's Mr. Grant Hutchison. My friend, what have you been up to today?
Nothing to do with, well, I did do some cider things, but I sold a flat and got a house today.
Hey! He's all grown up. He's all grown up. Well, actually, you bought your place years and years ago, didn't you? You're far more grown up than me. So, well, congratulations, my friend. That's all very exciting stuff,
yeah,
isn't
well
it?
Done, so, I'm celebrating by hanging out with you two wonderful people.
Oh, thank cool. you very much. That's kind. I think you're probably wrong for doing that, but that's not the point. And I'm sure that your lovely wife is very happy that you're doing so as well. Is there a cider that you are drinking in celebration of such a momentous occasion?
Well, currently I am drinking a single variety Sherrington Norman from Ross-on-Wye. A while back I bought a mixed case of single varieties from them as a sort of educational tool to learn more about single varieties and what different flavors you get, what different things they can bring to a blend, and so that when I'm talking about it and selling cider, I can sound like I know a little bit about what I'm talking about. So this is my last one, Sherrington Norman.
Nice. From memory, Sherrington Norman's quite it's a pretty rare variety, I think, actually. I suspect that's probably the only Sherrington Norman single variety being made in the world. And for our listeners who are new to the Neutral Cider Hotel, this is the joyous thing all about cider, is the magic is you actually make cider quite a lot like you make wine, whereby the varieties, they are your primary ingredient that have the greatest impact over the overarching flavor profile of the cider. So we'll quite possibly, during the course of this podcast and many to come, talk about apple varieties that you would have never have heard of before. And that's fine, because pretty much nobody has heard of these varieties before, because cider makers historically haven't really talked about them. But this is why it's a really important thing that people are starting to talk about, so we can learn that there are differences. And if you're listening to this podcast, you're pretty much on the cutting front edge of cider. Join us for the ride and welcome in to the hotel. We've got half rooms are booked out because of COVID, so there's a lot of personal attention. We're going to have a lot of fun. Enjoy your stay. Let's get into the news. And so now for the news, I'll kick off. The Big Apple is an event that is important to many people in the cider community, especially that of Herefordshire. And it's one of the big events that we all look forward to. And unfortunately, this autumn it's had to be cancelled because of the COVID conditions. It's something that I've been involved with for a number of years on the committee. In fact, I still technically am on the committee, but I'm allowed to not actually turn up, which is pretty good. And I
is there a cider committee that you're not on, Gabe? Can I just put that out there?
Not many. Well, yeah, probably not many. I'm not part of the Three Counties Cider.
I resigned.
I resigned.
Right, okay. Yeah. Oh, so you're voluntarily not part of it. That's very different. You walked away from that.
The point he was getting at was you've got fingers in all these pies, and you went, not the ones I have taken them out of.
Not the ones that were too hot for my finger.
I'm quite juicy with my choice of pie these days. I used to go for any pie, but now it's, I'm steak and mince.
You've grown up, that's fine.
Yeah. You've grown up by buying a house. I've grown up by narrowing down my pie selection. I don't know, quite an accurate analogy of our life, actually, Grant. Anyway, so to lament the Big Apple and to say that it's a fantastic event. And for anybody, if you're in the UK during the first May Bank holiday weekend next year, hopefully everything being going ahead, and the second weekend in October, this is the Big Apple happening at those two times of year. And it's the springtime event that is really, really awesome, because that's when the sort of regional cider competition takes place. It's the one that everybody wants to win. And I normally make about 50 or 100 liters of cider and perry a year, pretty much just so I can enter that competition. So I need to get my pear picking on and go and get some fruit so I can enter the competition. Anyway, Big Apple, we're going to miss you. We'll see you next year. Gents, what else is in the news?
So, a little bit late, but always good to mention it. It's the latest Graffwood came out. It's a zine of all things cider by James Forbes of Little Pomona and Albert Johnson of Ross on Wye. I think I'm in it. I think I wrote something for it.
Get out of town. What did you write?
Did you?
I wrote
a love letter to cider.
Yeah.
I've done my research.
I haven't even got it yet.
Read them out.
Are you not a subscriber? Read it out,
mate. If my wife sees one more thing of cider that I've spent money on,
I actually thought it was lovely. I thought it was really lovely. Yeah, you're a very good writer.
Thank you. Not just cocky not shit.
Not just writing on bottles of cider.
Yeah. No. Hieroglyphic.
Yeah, also print actually is much better than my handwriting, which is just a bonus to read, I guess.
Absolutely, yeah.
Can you give us a line?
So here's this is what was taken out to be sort of featured so that you would then go and read it. Yes, it can quench thirst in the sun. It can be swirled and studied. It can be forward thinking, and it can also be drunk simply for its alcohol.
That's alcohol. That's cider.
Well, you've what else have we got to talk about in this podcast? You just ruined it. You just nailed cider in a sentence, you bastard.
it does actually done that a few times in here. It's really...
He's annoyingly succinct, isn't he?
Annoyingly succinct. Brilliant.
I think that's probably the first and only time I'll have that attributed to my character.
Not annoying.
Annoying. Fuck you.
It's the first thing you get succinct. Yeah.
I'm aware. Fucking hell. All right, yeah, I'll get rinsed. And I'll get rinsed by announcing something I wrote as news. So we'll move on.
No, it is news. Again, for the people who are maybe not up with their cider news, Graffwood is a great zine. That's was started by two of the best UK cider makers, Albert from Ross on Wye and James from Little Pomona. You should go and check it out. Graffwood.co.uk. If you
they've
want
also got back issues up there as well, and the art, it's like art, poetry, and news, all of that combined. Oh, I'll just kick something. Art, news, poetry combined to show you the whole sort of like spectrum of cider. Yeah, and yeah, it's a lovely read.
It's cider stories, I think, is what it is to me. You know, it's not. It's not.
How annoyingly succinct of you to sum it up.
what's more annoying is that that's what I was exactly going to say the same thing, and that's the. I think that's
we can edit it out.
No.
No, on you go, on you go, on you go, Gabe.
For me, it is cider's. I think its greatest attribute is the stories that sit behind it, the people that sit behind it. And yes, that can be ye olde worldy and going back several generations and 200-year-old trees, or it could be the cider making on the smaller scale in a kitchen in a city. It's the people and the stories that make cider, I think, unique and different from other drinks. It comes from a different place. And it's really exciting. And to have something like Graffwood as a space and a place to tell those stories is a really awesome thing. So everybody, sign up now.
I will say, it's. I guess you could sum it up as cider stories.
You could.
How annoyingly succinct of you.
I wouldn't advise that. Sounds pretty boring.
Yeah, I think afterwards the way to go. So moving on, we have a story about apple trees being resurrected in Dorset. Who picked this one out?
I did. I was just on Bridport and Lyme Regis News, obviously. No, there's a
hotbed of current articulate political debate. Very good, yeah.
Yeah, my subscription was just like buzzing out to me on keywords. But no, I had a look, and the article is called Apple Trees Resurrected in Quest to Find Real Dorset Cider. And Nick Poole, cider maker at West Milton Cider Company, and in collaboration with pomologist Liz Kopass, I believe it's pronounced.
That's right.
They've resurrected 22 old cider apple trees from farms and gardens. And the trees of each variety have had their DNA sequenced for registration, apparently, if that makes sense. And their DNA has linked their lineage to the trees that French monks brought over during the Norman conquest. So the goal is to make cider with those to just see what it was like back then, which I thought was just a fucking cool thing. I really like that news.
Could you say that this is where science, cider, and history collide, Martin?
Yeah, I think they're using science to tell cider stories.
What would you call that category? science story. That's why we call it.
Actually, it's science triology. When you put an ology on the end, does anybody remember the old BT adverts from, sorry, anybody not from England of a certain age, the old BT adverts from the, I'm going to say, early 90s with Maureen Lipman, where she played the sort of the classic stereotypical Jewish mum, and her son gave her a phone call to say that he'd managed to pass sociology, and she said, oh, you've got an ology, you see? I've got an ology too. In fact, I've got Ciderology, a wonderful publication, a wonderful book that's been out for a couple of years now, but still makes a great Christmas present. Check it out now. Oh, Ciderology by Gabe Cook.
I'm going to say, when I was at Pilton today, I went to put on some music. He's got this really nice speaker set. And it's on the shelf in the back of the cidery. And, you're connecting up the USB to the iPhone, putting on music, and out of the corner of my eye, there's a copy of your book used to hold something up as a prop, to prop up a box that has different labels for old ciders that he doesn't make anymore. And I thought, I'm going to have to fucking remember this. I didn't check if it was signed, but I bet it's signed.
The most expensive doorstop and wedge, the poor bugger. Actually, I probably gave it to him. Yeah. But anyway, the plug is a plug.
Yeah, Gabe, one thing with it, it's a good hardback, and it's
quite
durable. It's a good structural device,
isn't it? Yeah, no, it's sturdy. It is sturdy. It was the thing I was most impressed about upon first receiving a copy of the book was its robustness. there being some words on the inside of it. So, yeah.
Did you buy that copy yourself?
There is a quite a high probability. I wonder if I look back at how many copies of the book that I have personally purchased, it will be a slightly despairingly large proportion. But this is what you do as an author, apparently.
Can you just confirm that this isn't a POM pyramid scheme? And in fact, it is a product that you would buy if you were interested in cider, and our audience, who are the target audience for the book as well, might actually want to buy it.
You see, pyramid scheme is it's a very loaded term. I prefer to do a long-term investment strategy with minimal outcome potential, but potential for great glory at the same time. So, would you also like to talk about property in Marbella as well at the same time? Got a good deal going on.
Okay, we're done talking about ciderology? Are we done talking about ciderology? Yeah.
Please, dear God.
Actually, can I just say one last thing? It's actually a pretty good book. So if you are listening in, the amount that we slag it off, it's good. Bye.
It is. I lent mine to my brother-in-law, who's a sommelier but is interested in cider. And it's one of those where it's a great starting point, and it's also a great well of information if you're actually into it and want to go deeper as well. So I know we've ribbed you enough, but... just fucking buy it for him.
Well, the ribbing will continue henceforth as well, but we just, you know, we have a little break.
I won't be able to leave the house. It's actually a physiological necessity for me to keep in my place. So thank you very much. But please do buy the book, because I do need to eat. And we've got, to finish off the news, we've got an interesting article has popped up about the etymology of the word cheers. What is the deal around that?
That was myself, Grant, here, that found
you
this.
You coined the word cheers.
Sorry, I realised that.
The levels of bravado are amazing in this guy, because he was in a rock band.
Shit. Why do we say cheers, Grant?
So, this is a BBC article, a little video, a little clip from Susie Dent, who is, I was going to say, you know, Susie Dent, I was going to say something like, you know, our most well-known etymologist. I don't know any other ones, so that's about as high a compliment as I can give her. But so it originates from the Latin word cara, which means head or face, which then traveled to France, presumably with the Romans, and it became cher, C-H-E-I-R. Which ultimately became cheer in English. Initially, it was used to describe someone's facial expression, and it could describe a good or a bad facial expression. It wasn't always a positive thing. So, for instance, currently, Martin's I would maybe describe as a cheer of boredom and confusion.
Well, I'm actually holding back a descriptive joke of Cher, so just move on from me, mate.
Why? Well, but you have to do it now, because otherwise it's good. No. Okay.
I wanted to say it, and I thought, that's gone. So that's why I have a face.
But it was gone, but you still brought it up, so...
Well, it's because you brought up my expression, so I thought, well, now he's brought me back in, I want to at least explain myself.
And so now there is a legitimate reason to tell the joke, so we can conclude the circle of doom. Come on.
Oh, Christ. I can't believe you had to explain a joke you didn't even tell.
Well, if anything's going to bring cheer, it's going to be me imagining an impression I'm going to do of Cher and then it not landing. So I don't know if I can commit this impression of Cher to air. But in my head, I'm like, yeah, that's if I was a drag queen, I would do it. Perfectly right now. No. Move on.
Okay. So from there, it didn't become a positive thing until the early 19th century. And when it got its way into drinks was cheers as as a toast, which is linked to putting toast in. What they would do in medieval times is put spiced toast into their wine to, I don't know, and make it easier to drink, make it more enjoyable. So the when you are standing up raising a toast, the person you are toasting is the toast in the spiced toast in the wine, and they are adding cheer to the celebration, and therefore cheers. It's quite So
the Martin, you're connected to the something.
You're the spiced toast in my wine. Is what you might say.
I will say, doesn't it just make you feel so fucking glad you're not a peasant in medieval times? Just like, I've got my first glass of wine. I'm gonna put some spiced toast in it. Like, fuck off. Just
yeah. I bet the peasants were probably going around mine sweeping all the glasses, all the goblets for the soggy toast.
Yeah, I'm really hungry. I haven't eaten in days. Have you got a glass of wine with some toast in it?
Yeah. Here, peasant, have my spiced toast.
Oh, I'm pretty cheery.
I'm pretty sure that as well as it being wine, it was also sort of a proto kind of like mead and beer and bits of cider, like alcoholic hodgepodge of different fermentable kind of things got the spicy toast kind of treatment, as certainly that was popular back in the from sort of Saxon times, I think. So yeah,
well, there you go. But then I also thought we could maybe, you know, as we could introduce the fact that cider has its own cheers.
It does. Should we save that for another episode? Is this a whole thing in its own right?
Secret one.
Yeah. I know, you can't wait. In fact, you've already ditched this episode to go forward, haven't you? We're in January 2021 and you're sat in your basement listening to Neutral Side. I don't know why, but you got so excited that you fast forwarded to the latest episode, which is titled Wassail, and you're going to go straight to there. Well, you're about to miss the most engaging bit of conversation, everybody. Like, really, really engaging conversation, everybody.
Who's saying it?
I've slightly lost track of receiving it or the other person. Why don't we finish the news on a positive note? Thank you, everybody, and let's move on.
Wassail, everyone.
Wassail. There we go. Wassail.
Oh, is it not cheers?
Oh, cheers.
Cara.
Guys, we fucked this right.
Let's go Italiano. Cara.
Cara, that is face. Let's just say face.
Face. Everybody listening, in your cider face. Has its own cheers. Face.
As you can tell, dear listeners, cider is in its infancy when it comes to language and communication, and we don't always necessarily get everything right. And this podcast is not necessarily any different from that. But we are on the road to discovery. We're opening the conversation, and you're very valiantly joining us. So thank you very much for coming through with us here at the Neutral Cider Hotel. That wraps up the news. Let's move on to the big interview.
I'm fucking Cher.
At the Neutral Cider Hotel, it's time to speak to some important guests. Every week, we bring on some big hitters from the cider world to talk about their perspective on the world of the fermented apple. And this week is no different, except for the first time we've gone somewhere other than the UK. We've gone abroad. Grant, where have we gone to and who are we talking to?
So tonight, checking in with us here at the Neutral Cider Hotel, we have two of the most accomplished cider makers in the world, hailing from Eve's Cidery in the Finger Lakes region of New York, an orchard-based organic cidery with a focus on terroir, an incredible catalogue of apple varieties growing on their orchards. Last count for me on the website was 49. And to quote their own biography, we work hard, we are often uplifted by the result, and we are battered and awed by the outside world together. Ladies and gentlemen, Autumn Stoshek and Ezra Sherman. How are you guys?
Good. I mean, I'm exhilarated, actually.
Are you? That's fantastic to hear. That's more than most get on the show, so we're very happy to hear that.
I would like to start off by asking your own question back at you. Can you taste a place?
Did we say that?
Okay, well,
that should be actually a pretense for one of your shows, you know, like maybe do a blind tasting and see if you can taste a place.
Oh, we've got a new producer. Oh,
I threw it back at you. You're now throwing it back at me. This is like, this is not really how it's meant to go.
That's a politician's deflect, isn't it? I'm going to ask you a question, what you said. Let me be clear.
I'll say something. We were talking about this with somebody in the past week, but I can't remember the exact conversation. But it's an interesting idea that this idea of terroir is what you're tasting, like what you're looking for, because you're attaching like some significance to where the cider is coming from. You know, like you've looked at photos and you've read the descriptions of the cider, and you're pulling out of the cider what your imagination sort of projects on it. Or is it literally like as if you didn't like wander the world and have all these experiences and kind of make up and are just approaching it as a tasting machine, like you just have this acuity in your mouth to pick up different sensations, you know?
I know the conversation you were talking about, because we were talking about our own tasting notes that we were creating for our cider release, and noticing that so many of the descriptors that we were finding in the cider were elements of the landscape around us, you know? So like, rose hips, there's wild roses that grow everywhere on our hillside. And, we were tasting like this really red rose, like concentrated red fruit rose hips in one of the ciders. Or we were tasting goldenrod, which is, there's where we live this time of year, fields and fields and fields and fields of yellow with that sort of honey, very like rich honey nectar smell. And so I think that was sort of a question. Do we taste that because that's our lived experience? Mm-hmm. Or do we taste that because in fact, the trees that grow here like are sort of absorbing the qualities of the environment like into the apple?
Which is terroir. So we're hoping that we're going to bring in some listeners who are new to cider and possibly don't know all the terminology of it. And you mentioned terroir, and I think it's a good point now to explain that terroir would normally mean the land, the climate, the geographical location of an orchard and those trees that the apples grow on that go into the cider. And what I liked again from conversations with you guys and from what I know about your cider is that you also feel that the human element of the terroir contributes to the cider as well. Is that right?
Yeah, and I think I would add to that also something that's sort of become of increasing importance to me, both as an orchardist and a cider maker, is the sort of microbiological ecological community that is both in the soil of the orchard and living on the skins of the fruit. And then because we do our ciders with wild yeast fermentations that are sort of really specifically about using the yeasts on the skins of the fruit that we're fermenting, also the communities that live on those fruits. So I think that's a part of terroir as well.
And I wonder if along those lines, if like a producer, let's say an orchard combined with a cidery, terroir becomes more distinctive like over time as that those practices sort of favor certain yeasts and
so you're saying your approach
becomes more and more accentuated, like I'm sorry.
So no, I was just gonna say do you imagine that your approach would be different to making the cider if you were not if you went where you are?
Yes. Yeah, I think right. So.
Like okay. In what way?
So much of it, I don't know.
What is a tangible? What do you mean by the approach would be different?
So if you're growing apples in Virginia mm-hmm. and not in the Finger Lakes in New York,
right.
Would you approach the orchard differently? Would you pick different varieties? Would you
right.
would you yeah. press
absolutely it?
Right? So that's very nuts and bolts.
Yeah let's get a bit nuts and bolts.
But it is. But it's also like just to get back to the human influence. I mean, just like what you're saying, the varieties that you choose to grow on your site because they grow better there. Or the time of year that you're harvesting a particular variety and what's actually like kind of going on that time of year. Is that background noise too much? Are you picking
that
up?
No, that's fine. That's fine.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. You're in our house and
you're making us feel very welcome.
So guys, you're in the middle of harvesting right now, aren't you? And as I've had the pleasure and the opportunity of not only visiting you, but having your hospitality as well a couple of years ago, I know that you have a very, very hands-on approach to your cider making personally in terms of you, the whole family is involved and your level of mechanization is the level that you deem it to be. And you really do like to be, really kind of hands-on, and you got a crew. And what I liked and still do like about, part of your approach is that you're sharing and in terms of, being part of a community, but you take on an intern every year, don't you? And you give them the opportunity to be in a nice sort of shack on your bit of land and to really, sorry, that might be underselling it to someone, a nice timbered chalet.
Somebody looked at it and thought it was a smokehouse. Just a couple of weeks ago, last week. Anyway,
get to work, smoke boy.
Yeah, but I really appreciate that. And so keep going.
You really do place that emphasis. And one of the things about cider is that, trying to get new people into it and trying to upskill people. And that can either be in a very sort of, technical approach from a scientific way or from, again, that, I suppose, more agricultural, even sort of permacultural approach to things. And tell us a little about some of the people that you've had over the years and their sort of backgrounds and their stories and things. Because we've been talking about cider as being about stories, because this is what we all love about cider. And you've got many of those.
So I would just jump in and say that we've just been so like happy and excited about the interns that we've had since we started doing an internship. And it's really cool to see, especially, when we've been doing this for 20 years, and I definitely think it was a crazy thing to have done. And I don't think I would do it again.
What?
I mean, I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying,
in other words, you wouldn't have the energy.
I wouldn't. It would be too exhausted. Yeah, I did. Or if I had any idea, I would have been like, "That's crazy! Like, no way!" But it's so inspiring and heartening to see young people, just be so like so passionate and ready to like leave careers. I mean, we had one of our interns was a creative writing professor. And then we also had
Grant and Gabe both
Matt. And last year we had a professional bassoonist.
That's a thing. Hold on.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, she's an incredible musician. She played every instrument there was, but she was...
She was like when...
She hit pro status with a bassoon.
Oh, you can see a video of her. She was in this past holiday video playing her bassoon as the...
One of many bassoonists.
But she was like such a great musician. We heard this like Appalachian like banjo music coming from the wabin, and we like opened the window and she was like teaching herself the banjo and sounded
like a professional.
Like
I know.
A professional.
Is there always an element of creativity with the people that I feel that's quite important with what you do.
I think the two things that you brought up, like both the hands-on and the internship, are both like really rich subjects and are things that we talk about a lot. And the interns are something that we just have been talking a lot about what a great thing it is for us to have these like people coming in. Mm-hmm.
But I think there is some kind of link there for sure. I see that not just like in our interns, but also in like within the cider community in the Finger Lakes and your state, that a lot of times people who get into cider apple orcharding and cider making are artists in some form or another, like through another medium.
I feel like cider, you know, I don't have much experience in the creation of beer or the beer industry or wine either, but cider, with the cider makers I know, the balance of science versus art for me is more skewed towards art or intuition or something, you know, something other than science and just following a book and following a recipe. What do you think about that? What's your approach? How much of it is science? How much of it is art? Do you intuitively make cider, or do you make cider based on numbers?
Yeah, no, definitely not. But I mean, we write things down, we take notes, but I think the way that we make cider is really similar to the way that we grow apples, which is also similar to, I think, the way that we garden and plant flowers. And for me personally, I think that it's about, and this is like kind of where it's related to art. It's about observation. An observation like on not just like one level, if that makes sense, you know, like I think, especially when you're like sort of trying to like be in a relationship with the natural world or be like attuned to the natural world, you know, there's more than just like your one sense, like sight involved or something like that. And it's more than just what you're seeing now today. And it's more than just even what you can see. There's like the signs of what you can't see to let you know what else is happening. And I think that's maybe like that kind of observation or like listening or seeing is something that connects it to art.
And did you learn that in terms of orcharding and cider making, or from, you know, 2001, were you just like, yeah, I can see where this apple's going, I can see where this cider's going?
It's a process that you're always learning. Yeah.
That's great.
I think this is all of this experience is built up together to enable you to create, in what is my opinion, one of the world's great ciders, which is Albie Hill. You have many, many good ciders. I like all of your ciders. But with Albie Hill, it was... Yeah, I know. And I have to say, it does feature in Ciderology by Gabe Cook, available now. Eves is one of the featured cider makers. And Albie Hill is the standout cider. I had it for the very first time I had it was in the sadly now defunct Wassail in Manhattan. And it was the first time I had ever had cider poured out of a 750ml bottle into a glass. And I had to pay, you know, some money for it. And it was amazing. I mean, the experience of doing that was amazing, and the cider was amazing. And obviously, I sort of got to meet you and sort you out and understand, you know, what and where it's made, and the concept of being made from this orchard, and that it changes every year because, you know, it's the perfect bottle to give to people, especially if you have two vintages of it, to showcase to people that cider is made from apples, and those apples change year on year. And if you are making an orchard blend, there are some varieties that come to the fore in some years and other years. So it's a brilliant and very, very easy way, and thankfully, to tell cider's story and about that sort of narrative, and especially so in the UK, because our dear friend Mr. Hutchison here is able to bring some of your fantastic ciders into our side of the pond so that we can continue to tell that story. So just, yeah, wow. Albie Hill, it's something kind of magic.
That was my that was my Christmas Day cider this year. Cracked that with a family.
There you go.
Absolute stunner.
Thank you.
No, thank you.
I don't know. There was a question.
Did you have a question?
I'm not sure I did. I think I was just trying to sell more copies of my fantastic
book. Well, I actually have. I want to respond to that because that's sort of like the ultimate. That's like the final piece of making cider, you know, because you started off this interview saying, can you taste a place? And, you know, that question is still out there and is, you know, there for different people to answer in different ways. But certainly that's kind of our life's work, is to, you know, try to get better and better at expressing the place through the cider in, you know, like sort of in the purest way that we can. And just, you know, just putting it into the bottle and then saying goodbye to it sort of isn't the end of the story. It's when somebody drinks it. And so it's really gratifying to hear about people tasting it, because, you know, we don't always get to hear from everybody who's tasted it.
So what did the Eve's Cidery, the Orchards, what did they look like when you arrived? When you first started out, what did you arrive at? Was it existing orchards?
That's a really good question. Well, you know that Autumn planted like the first orchard with her dad up on the hill here. I don't know what the land looked like that they planted the CL orchard.
So where we live is right on the edge of the Northern Appalachian Plateau and the Southern Finger Lakes. So it's basically where the Appalachian Mountains kind of crash into this sort of plain where the Finger Lakes were carved by glaciers, and that sort of culminates in the Great Lakes. And it's a really like steep and rugged terrain for New York State, for the area, and really deep valleys that were carved by glaciers, and not like the most sort of like luscious, easy to use farmland. And so in the 30s, during the Depression in the United States, a lot of the farms here were abandoned because they were small scale, kind of like small diversified family farms, and farming in the United States has just over the past, you know, 70, 80 years become more and more consolidated into industrial agriculture in places where it's conducive to using large machinery and, you know, burning up the topsoil and all that stuff. So there's a lot of forest, and there's a lot of farmland that's going back to forest. And so our farm is kind of a mix of that, and the orchard sites are like little fields, like old hay fields and cleared areas scattered around a steep hillside.
Yeah, so, and when we I think made the decision to move out here, actually, and to buy a portion of Autumn's family's land, we looked for a site for another orchard. And basically, I think the site was chosen because it was shallow enough to navigate with a tractor, partly. It's like just barely, you know, shallow enough. And so we spent a lot of time clearing it. It was just kind of woods.
And And was it, did you always want to be an organic cider?
That's a good question too. I mean, when we started out, I think we were like fully, when I became involved, I remember spraying like Metasystox,
my
backpack sprayer.
My sort
with
of
like a ventilator and like almost
like a Ghostbuster
in the summer. Yeah, like a Ghostbuster. Exactly. And I enjoyed the name of the chemical because it sounded like what it is.
I got into orcharding through I learned from growers who were whatever IPM growers, and when I started working on orchards in 1999, the sort of prevailing wisdom is that it is completely impossible to grow apples organically in the Northeast of the United States because it's a humid climate and the disease pressures are simply too high. And that was sort of the end of the story, pretty much a viewpoint that was supported by people in orcharding and also, you know, the educational institutions like Cornell University, which is our land grant college. I didn't get into orcharding like as an idealist about organic agriculture by any means. And I've also sprayed my share of awful chemicals that I, you know.
But you don't. But you don't know, right?
You don't know what.
You don't do it now.
No, no. I mean the big turning point that Kate gave.
Tell me it's not true.
No.
I want a discount on my next order.
Yeah. No. But I mean the big turning point came for me when I had my first child, and
who's making a face at us?
Oh my gosh,
right now.
Who's 14 now,
but which
she's
again
sticking
I
her
think
tongue out at me
brings in that beautiful human element you spoke about that's related to terroir again, you know, because that's something that well you're about to tell the story, but I assume, you know, that's where it's taken us is that this, you know, literal human changed
that's
the course of your orcharding. So please tell a story. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, the story is that I was working in the orchard doing a grafting project, actually, during the spring that she was probably 6 months old. And
hold on. I'm trying to get this. Is that horse working? Why is the horse not working?
It is.
So, can you hear the horse, guys?
Yeah, I heard it kind of.
We can hear it slightly muted.
Now, Grant, would you like to explain why you've just interrupted?
Explain the muted.
So the horse that we have during this podcast, it's called the horse of knowledge. Whenever there's a term that comes up that maybe our listeners might not know of, we introduce the horse and we explain what that is. So you said you were on a grafting project, and I felt like maybe grafting is something that people might not understand what that is.
Oh, okay.
So a very quick explanation of exactly what that is. But you're probably better at it than me because you've done it. I've never done it. I'm just a guy that drinks cider.
But apple trees are vegetatively propagated. They're not planted from seed, generally
speaking.
We need
the horse again, right? No,
you need a choice. Vegetative and propagated. Okay, I'm not saying anything about your scat. I mean, that's a little bit insulting.
You can't just plant an apple tree. You need to graft.
No, you can't. And every single, you know, every single Davinet tree that ever has existed since Davinet was a variety, came from a cutting yeah. of the original Davinet tree. So somehow, if you want to have a variety with a specific quality and a specific name, you have to find some plant material from a tree. And then there's a process of matching the cambium tissue of your scion, which is going to be the variety that you want, with whatever you're using for the roots. In this case, we were top grafting trees in our orchard that were dessert varieties, like modern dessert varieties that really have no place in cider, over to cider specific varieties.
Lovely. Okay. So Kay, you can carry on your actual story now. That's
in regards to the transition to organic.
Yeah. So the actual story is just that I worked all day and then my mom or somebody was watching, Ezra's parents were watching the baby, and I was hurrying home to take a shower so I could go breastfeed her. And I just sort of had this realization when I was taking a shower that I had had the chemicals all over my body all day long, and that they had certainly soaked into my skin. And I think when you're like young and you have like some certain attitude or whatever, you think, oh, I'm like, this doesn't matter. Like, I'm impervious to this. I'm like tough or whatever. And then, you know, my mindset really changed when, of course, I had my child, that all I wanted to do was to protect her and keep her safe. And the thought that I would be like harming her myself through like her very sustenance was like really shocking. And I think that's just that very moment I thought, you know what, this is crazy. Like, either we have to find a different way to do this, or we're not going to do this, because what kind of world is a world that's so toxic that it can hurt your children?
And presumably that was a decision which, like you say, involved probably a lot more work.
And not only that, but like I said to you, it wasn't like, oh, okay, sure, just go be organic. Like, go get the book on organic apple orcharding in New York State and just follow that book instead. Seriously. I mean, we've spent, you know, a decade and a half really actually making it up. You know, I don't want to make it sound like we're the only people ever. There's an amazing sort of network of people in the Northeast who are sharing knowledge and meeting and talking about problems and working on different solutions and sharing their successes and failures. But yeah, it's not only a lot more work, but like the risk goes up astronomically, you know, the potential to like totally mess everything up and lose your crop and all of that stuff. So it already was like a high stress, high stakes kind of job, but we definitely upped the ante on that one.
I feel like in the beginning, maybe it was way more stressful, but now I feel like it's probably, well, it was less stressful in the sense of it being, you know, safer to be a farmer with that pest management approach. But I feel like now it's probably less stressful than using a conventional. And I think partly maybe because when Autumn changed our direction, she was a huge trendsetter. And I feel like maybe there wasn't the industry support for organics. But now it seems like there's, I don't know if like some of the products that we use, like immune, acquired immune boosting, like stuff was available back then. It seems like there's been almost a resurgence in orchard organic materials.
Yeah. People want to feel more connected to the process and the product, and for a lot of people, the organic gives them that. You know.
Well, you know, this is the reality, because I've lived on both sides of that, you know, that picture in agriculture, and people do want to be more connected to agriculture. They want to be more connected to their food, and they should be. But if people really knew what was going on in a lot of farms and the way that their food was being grown, they would freak out. And it's a problem, for example, here in the wine industry in New York State, in the Finger Lakes wine industry, which I took a sabbatical in 2018 and worked on my friend's vineyard over on Seneca Lake, and tried to help him develop an organic management program for his Pinot Noir vineyard. And it's the same situation with grapes now as it sort of is with apples. And wine consumers are really starting, you know, there's stories about glyphosate in wine, you know, like Roundup in wine and all that kind of stuff. And people are really starting to turn their eye toward the farming practices as they should. And it's causing, you know, it's causing farmers to need to up their game, which is awesome. It's the way it should be.
Well, it harks back to what you were saying at the start about like observing your environment and what grows there. And like, are you seeing rosehip in it because it's there, or have you come to it with that? And with this whole sort of approach to organic and everything that the consumer's having as well, is it that people like yourselves that have observed it and changed it are giving them a new observation and opening it up? Like, you need almost like a whistleblower like yourself to say, like, this is how it needs to change. Because a lot of people were just drinking wine, cider and everything medicinally to get drunk. And now it seems like people are getting way more attached to it. And it's down to people like yourselves actually hitting it out of the park, really.
It's a feedback loop. You know, it just, it keeps getting better.
Well, so who right now in the US are you excited about in terms of making cider?
That's a good question. Well, I'm really excited to see all of our interns' projects.
Of course.
You know.
So you let your interns have projects within the cidery that they...
Well, they came to us with their own vision of having their own cidery and have left to pursue to continue their pursuit
Of
it, you know, because they only come to us for 9 months or something like that.
Right. Okay.
And both Maddie Matt and Catherine have gone on to pursue their dreams, and then
our current intern is also working on starting her cidery as well. Yep.
She's great.
Yeah. So that's exciting because all of them are, like, their heads are screwed on straight. Like, they've got the right idea and they're taking the long approach, you know? And I also continue to feel excited about what's going on here in the Finger Lakes. I think that there's a group of producers that kind of keep pushing each other in a competitive way, but also in a collegial way to get, better and better.
So there's a good community there.
There's a great cider community here. Yeah. Yep. It's small, but it's slowly growing.
And tell us about the apple varieties that you use. You've already alluded to the fact that you use cider apples, and you know, we're talking about apple varieties that originated from our side. That there aren't actually so many of these orchards planted up in the US. And you know, you're part of a relatively early kind of stages of movement. Tell us about the varieties that you've got and why you've got them and why you use them and why they're significant to the drinks that you produce. Because for all of the attitude and ethos and wild yeast and everything, ultimately, very large driver of what your product's going to turn out are those varieties, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, we really love English bittersweets and,
There's no equivalent to like the bittersweet fruit really in the US. And even when people are looking for potential cider apples, like in the wild, in seedlings, which is something a lot of people are doing, I've never really come across anything, you know, just because it has tannin in it, it's not the same kind of tannin and that combination of the really, really, really sweet, ripe aromas combined with like smoky tannins. So we love European bittersweet fruit, French and English. There's some challenges to growing them here and we're finding those out. That's one of sort of like the constraining factors, I think, besides the fact that, a lot of those varieties are so untame or something to grow. Look at a Jonagold or some apple that just is, you know, works really well. It has the right shape. It has the right combination of you know, spurs and tip bearing, and it pretty much bears every year, and big apples, easy to pick, all that kind of stuff, right? You know, and then look at Kingston Black. Oh my God.
It's a quick story. This has never happened before, but we experienced like a close to a drought since I don't know when.
Since July.
Okay. And I mean, the fruit is like, seems to be great quality, but I don't think this ever happened. And English bittersweets are dry to begin with. And we have a rack and cloth press, you know, we have a nice big grinder and then a pump at the bottom of the hopper below the grinder. And Autumn did a press with Katie and Aaron, and the Kingston Black was so dry that it wouldn't pump after it was ground.
We had to scoop it. But the Brix was 18 and a half.
Amazing. Again, for our listeners, Brix is the measurement of the sugar content. So, and you know, a Brix of 18 would equate to a potential alcohol of pushing 10%. That's some pretty bulky stuff we got right there. And this is the really interesting thing. Of course, again, we're talking about, you know, terroir. Terroir can also be a case of a variety like Kingston Black that is used to growing in the very gentle environment of Kingsbury Episcopi in the central Somerset, which is generally kind of damp and mild-ish. And during this time of year, when this fruit is coming, you know, when it's coming in, it'll drop and it'll sit in that long grass and it'll spend a long time sort of slowly maturing and building those kind of characters, you know, in a place where you are, where, you know, the overarching climate through the year is quite different, and how that impacts upon the fruit. And crucially, at this time of year, what happens?
Certainly it went through a frost.
Yeah, you know, so it does have a big impact. And Kingston Black, you know, plant, it's one of those varieties that I have had the fortune of tasting in Australia, in New Zealand, in various kind of parts. And there is obviously that Kingston Black profile, but they are noticeably different from place to place. And so it's no surprise that there are challenges. And Kingston Black aside, which everybody finds a pain in the ass to grow, it seems. But, you know, there are certain varieties that seem to lend themselves a little better. So do you have any kind of favorite bittersweet or any of those sort of tannic apples? If there's one that you could take only with you to, you know, the desert island, what would it be?
I know what I would do.
Okay. Well, okay, I've got two.
Come on, Edward. You've got to choose one. Okay, only one, my friend.
Only one. Okay, I'll choose one.
Oh, okay. So I'll choose one that's not English then. Are you going to choose?
You're growing rods, probably, but yeah, I'm going to choose two.
Well, somebody should do an English one. I was going to say Fricon Rouge.
You don't even have any.
Yeah,
I was going to say Fricon Rouge.
Fricon Rouge has been like a big success story in our orchard and in the cidery. But yeah, it's a super vigorous tree. So we have very poor like soils that are shallow and it's shale, and the tree has to like drill its roots down through like layers of rock to do anything to find the water. And so that tree has done exceptionally well on our hillside, and also seems to be, you know, have pretty nice green foliage in our organic management program and like humid climate. So one variety.
Nice. Fricon Rouge. It's not even a variety that I know particularly well.
You're both taking that. And
I think we are.
Okay, so I mean, what's a bitter? I mean, I would say like,
so hard
like
to choose one.
Dabinet, but I don't have that much experience like growing it. We have it young.
It's hard to pick one because I feel like there's so many. It's nice for us. In the stage that we're at with our orchard, it's really nice to have a variety because the years are so, the climate is so different here year by year. And the growing seasons are so different year by year, and different varieties are doing better in different years. And we're still really just learning. Yeah. I mean, how to grow these apples that we've really, you know, had in the ground only for 20 years and have been cropping really only for 14 years.
And there's been like a lot of
not a lot of time. 14 harvests, you know.
There's been a lot of two steps forward, one step back kind of situations where so like where I killed a few hundred trees, like
what I love about you guys and you the cider you make and the art of the blending that you guys do. You know, you've got that especially the Albie Hill, like Gabe mentioned, you know, the breakdown of the apples that are in there, and it's something that you always display on the label. Is that transparency important to you as cider makers, for people to know what's in there?
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think it was somewhat of a reaction to kind of being jaded by seeing claims of, you know, what's the craft, orchard-based, I don't know, marketing angles by some cideries. So having the explicit breakdown of the blend was sort of our counter shot or whatever. But it's also, I think, great for the consumer to wrap, you know, to turn the bottle around and see those variety names and then start becoming curious about it. You know, it's like when we drink a really great French wine or whatever, you know, you go online and you start looking at what it is about, what are the, like the details about this wine.
And what varieties they use.
What varieties they use.
And so on and so forth. And you know, I don't know like how you guys feel about your cider culture, which is so much older and so much richer than what we have here. But for us, like putting the varieties on the label felt like this really, really important step in. Oh my gosh, I'm going to grab that better. Really important step in getting people to wrap their mind around cider as something other than a beer alternative. Should we step outside? This is really loud. You know, other than a product where the raw ingredient is irrelevant, it's a source of sugar, you know, and mm-hmm. start getting them to wrap their minds around it being agricultural specific place with intentional varieties.
You might be surprised or not to hear that actually it's a very similar case over here. The actual overutilization of apple varietals on labels and packaging is in terms of endeavoring to explain what is in this product and that's why how it tastes is something that is only really sort of again in its first flush of being undertaken and certainly of being understood. And in terms of, you know, we're very early days in terms of endeavoring to create any kind of language around cider, certainly around stylization. But again, what I really like about Albie Hill is the fact that not only do you list all the varieties on there and in their exact proportions, which I like, but also the fact that you break it down into, you know, aroma, texture, and acidity. Three, you know, simple and clear things that any kind of consumer can understand and go, oh, okay, that's what it's all about. And it's just these simple things that I think are kind of really, that are really important and are, you know, are going to be the tools to which consumers can start to understand that cider can be the mainstream commercial thing. And that's fine if it has its place, but that doesn't necessarily what cider has to be, that there can be these different types, interpretations, styles with different sort of ethos and production. And just get it known and understood being this really, you know, diverse drink. So
yeah, totally. I think if you're a person who, you know, you start drinking cider and you're going to remain excited and engaged about it, like for your adult life, like you're going to want to know a lot. You're going to want to know, you're going to want to be able to explore. I want to taste Kingston Black from around the world, Gabe. That sounds amazing. That's why I'm interested in cider, you know?
That was some boast, Gabe. That was some boast.
Yeah, it's a pretty good life I've had traveling around the world drinking cider. Not that that's particularly possible at the moment. Mm. Maybe we'll get there.
Well, Ken, what do you guys have? Why don't we finish up with you telling us what you have coming up?
I think a couple of the things that seem really exciting is is Autumn's idea to do some pet gnat ciders from wild seedling fruit from distinct locations. The cider that you have, that De Ritter.
Yep.
Which you have.
I'm trying that tonight. Yep.
Nice. Really like that.
Oh, it is beautiful.
Well, don't spoil it. I've not had it yet.
I'm sorry. It's shite.
Yeah, who knows? Yeah.
Also, the label's great. Zuri did the label.
Well, yeah. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the label? But we're going to taste it once you've gone to avoid any awkwardness. But tell us a little bit about the label, because I think that's a really interesting story.
Well, the story I always tell is, I think it was maybe 3 years ago at Zuri. They have to listen to us talk about cider and I like business all the time. And it's just like annoying. But anyways, Zuri said, he said at one time when we were like kvetching about money and sales and stuff, he said, should I say it?
Yeah. What?
So he says, I know why you guys are, I was complaining about sales. Your labels are no good. Of course, Autumn does all the labels.
It's okay. Okay.
Autumn was like, and he's kind of, was anyway, more oriented to like the Angry Orchards, like over the top, like Headless Horsemen, like tons of kinetic action, Halloween kind of look. And so Autumn said, yay, okay, well, you can do a commercial label for one of our ciders. And so he did a label, which became the label for a wild pear.
Not a fan of the Perry, obviously.
Just to say, that isn't a sound of an animal that we're using to interject.
Whenever you hear a sketchy reference to child labor, the dog starts barking.
Also respond.
That's a signal to get off the illegal tangent. So yeah, that became the label for a pear apple cider, which was like half wild pear, and became it was called Skelepear because it looked like a skeleton celebrating with a liquor bottle.
Nice.
I remember the label. I tried some. It was quite a statement on the label.
Yeah. Yeah. And so this year, after we started a cider subscription and kind of had the fruit last year to make a bunch of single variety ciders, Autumn worked with both Layla and Zuri to do 8 labels.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And how much were they paid for each label?
$35.
This is really, I think,
but don't tell a big
criminal admission.
No, but you got to not tell our other cider making colleagues because
they're going to start hiring.
I was going to say because they pay too high and then their kids are going to get mad and go on strike.
People are going to be looking for their tax returns.
We pay too high.
Yeah.
What's wonderful with it?
Smirking in the background.
looking at the bottle. It's one where you drink with your eyes straight away, and we all saw that label online. And it's one of those that I was like, "Fuck! I've really got to get that cider." Like, I really, just looks with the clear glass and the label. It just looks like something special. And clearly artisanal and hand cared for. So it's just like, even as a kid drawing a label, it just matches clearly the ethos and everything. So it's sold it to us, definitely.
Oh, nice.
Well, that cider was kind of crazy what we did to make that cider. And actually, we made another one this year from the same place. But there's a grove of wild apple trees on what we call the Portage Escarpment, which is sort of that dividing line between the Finger Lakes and the Appalachian Mountains proper. It's just about like 8 miles from our house. And it's this incredible grove of trees where every single apple is completely different from the next one. And we picked the apples and hauled them out of the woods on our backs, you know, in sacks, for real. Like, we really did that. and yeah, so it's one of those ephemeral things, you know, there's not a lot of it. So enjoy it.
This is one, listen, this is a really exciting thing for, you know, for you guys, from being the, you know, the arch orchardists and being professional in terms of cultivating these known apple varieties and getting the best out of them, for changing tack and going kind of fully wild, as it were. It's a really exciting development and something that I'm looking to tasting very shortly. And that, unfortunately, brings an end to our time with you guys. We know that you're super busy at the moment, and so we thank you both very much for tearing yourself away from the orchard, or maybe you're slightly glad, because we know how very much hard work it is. For anybody who's listening in the US, please do check out Yves Cidery. It's evescidery.com is the website. A fantastic range of products. If you're ever in the Finger Lakes area, be sure to check them out. So Autumn, Ezra, thank you very much for your time, and yeah, good luck with the rest of the harvest. Neutral Cider Hotel, it's the time where we get to taste a cider all together and decide, what do we really think about it? What's it all about? And this week, following on from our fantastic talk with Autumn and Ezra earlier on, it's the cider that they were talking about, their new Derrida cider, which is a pet nat, which is a naturally in-bottle fermented cider. Made from this wild apple grove that they found up in the hills, where they quite literally hauled £1,000 worth, and that's as in the weight rather than the monetary value, on their backs out of the hills and back to the cidery. Chaps, what do we think?
Oh, that sound.
That's me failing to open it in one go.
It's got a good pet nat, good amount of bubbles.
It's got quite a mousse, isn't it? And it's really
look at that, you
it's really does. Retaining.
Mm.
But it looks it's a great Belgian beer, look, by the looks of it. Not that anybody who's listening can see it, but it really does retain the bubbles, which isn't such an easy thing to do without knowing anything about the science behind it.
And I find that's not as common with a pet nat as opposed to, you know, bottle fermented often has that mousse. Pet nats tend to the sort of mousse, the carbonation tends to disappear.
Do you mean like the method trad?
Method
in comparison to method trad.
Yeah.
Anyone want to do a horse there?
Oh, hang on. Oh no. Oh, there we go.
Is that Cher doing a horse?
Oh, I'm fucking Cher. If I could turn
back time. Oh, there it is. The horse of knowledge. Petion naturel, which I know gets the goat of some cider makers in the UK, because it's kind of like a classic. It's a wine term, and it means whereby the cider has finished its first fermentation in the bottle. So you got a little bit of natural fizz. It's kind of captured quite young, and you don't undergo a riddling and disgorging to remove the sediment like you would do in a method traditionnel, which is like the champagne method. So it does have sediment, and it is, you know, and as it is in this case, you know, lightly kind of hazy. So that, and in the UK, we would often call that as bottle conditioning. So there are some people who say that pet nat is just a bit of a, you know, it's a swanky term or something to add an extra few pounds onto the price of the bottle. I personally don't subscribe to that. It's more kind of an ideological point of view, in terms of especially something like this being a bit more like a natural wine. Again, folks, I know you can't see our faces, but Martin has just been pulling the most amazing face after his first taste of this cider. What do you get?
I just want to, in case it does make the edit, I do want to explain that my interjection of like a couple minutes ago was me just smelling it, loving it, and then sipping it, and it being 10 times
it being 10 times the flavor as the taste implies, if that makes sense. So a lot of these Pernats, they have a wonderful aroma and then they're quite lean, dry and quite gentle. And a lot of the cider makers that are making them in regions where they don't have kind of big, brassy tannic cider apples, and that they're using like dessert apples in most of them that I've had actually. And this one just has like an abundance of, it's like orange peel, stone fruit, crystal meth. It's got everything in the kitchen sink in there.
I tell you what,
like a proper perfume. It's insane.
They've got three. They got three terms at the very top of the packaging to describe what this cider tastes like. One is jingly acid, which I rather like the jingly tangerines. So spot on with your perception there, Martin. And maybe close to the crystal meth is seashells, which I know doesn't
Nature's crystal meth.
Nature's crystal meth is ground down seashells. And although they're obviously slightly esoteric kind of terms, I think they kind of were. Anyway, we haven't actually said what it tastes like. And I think that's because, ladies and gents, it's a really, really complex cider. There's a lot going on, but it is just utterly sublime. I tell you what, these guys, Eve Cider, there isn't a cider or a perry they make that I don't really, really enjoy. I genuinely do think they're one of the best cider makers on the planet. They always seem to encounter or create, I know it's wild for men, and that, you know, this is just what they've got, but balance, texture, the you know, acidity, sweetness, aromatics, it's always there in some kind of proportion. And maybe this is why, you know, you do a lot of work with them, Grant, because, you know, this is as good as it gets, right? This is fantastic. Well,
yeah, and what you know, these are apples that were, well, essentially scrumped, I guess, technically, right? You know, they didn't grow these apples. They saw them growing in a place where they were driving past and just decided to pick them and press them. So to get something as you said, as complex out of that with a wild fermentation where you're not introducing any cultured yeast that you know what they're going to do to the cider. You're literally just letting the cider ferment and then bottling it. Well, I was going to say bottling it when it's ready, but you're bottling it pet nat. So that's even, you know, it's another step of uncertainty to do. And it just, I have no idea how it's come out tasting so great, you know. Mm-hmm.
It's one of those where, like, it tastes like apples, lemons, pears, pineapples, oranges, all at the same time and at a different time. The acidity and that carbonation, it feels like a sherbet. And oh my god.
but it doesn't go too far. It's not
the acidity isn't like mouth puckering.
Nah, this is it. This is why it's just so clever that you've got all of the intensity of that acidity. And I can't imagine that there's any sugar in here, or maybe just a tiny little bit, but it's still soft and it's still round, and we've got a bit of nice sort of grippy astringency, but it's but again, it's not unpleasant. It is just an intense taste sensation.
It's almost like a Jesus. Cocktail. It's almost like a cocktail with bitters in it or something, you know. Because there's the alcohol, there's the alcohol there. There's
Martin's having bitters. Quite the moment over there, isn't he? Yes.
You know that we're recording this, Martin.
I don't give a fuck.
If you want to mute your mic whilst you,
it's having a private moment.
He's now holding the glass up to the mic. If anyone,
I haven't seen him smile in a very, very long time. He's normally got this kind of like faux, kind of bitchy face on the go. And
I don't think I've ever seen Martin smile.
And he's gurning like an idiot.
Yeah, well, that's what scrumpy does to a man.
It's true.
Now it's great. I've just poured another glass. If you couldn't tell, I enjoyed it and drank it very quickly. But it's genuinely got a finger's length of head on it still. And it, yeah, it's just a little stunner. Like that's a new benchmark. That's where I'm measuring them all from now. If it ain't this good, fuck off.
I mean, they should put that on the next bottle, right?
Yeah. I tell you what, I know that we, you know, are often positive about a lot of ciders because there are a lot of great ciders out there, but this sits in that sort of upper echelon of, you know, you'd give this to anybody who has a vague interest in interesting drinks and they will go, wow, this is a game changer. This is a cider. I didn't know that cider could do this, could give these flavor profiles, could have that experience, could be as bombastic and impacting. Next time you go to a dinner party, because everyone's going to dinner parties right now, of course, you know, bring a bottle of this along, and you know, you are going to make a statement and an impact. Actually, bugger that. Don't take it to a dinner party. Just drink it at home.
Yeah, drink it. Keep it for yourself.
In a dark room or in a bright room, whatever. It's just a great cider. It's a fantastic showcase. And from a really sort of selfish point of view, I'm really happy that this cider is in the UK, that this is, you know, a showcase of American cider, and, you know, people over here don't know anything about there's US cider. To be fair, a lot of people in the US don't know that there is an amazing cider industry. And so to have this over here available and to show to people, this is what cider can be about. It's awesome. And I'm just going to continue to talk until Martin stops drinking,
Martin, are you crying?
You do look.
Martin's crying.
I'm either crying or coming. One eye is leaking, I tell you that.
It's absolutely exceptional.
It's gorgeous, and I don't know, should I reiterate it? I'm usually annoyingly succinct, but I'm just head over heels with it. It's what I like about cider, though, is if you like it and you really like it, you can have genuine kind of kicks in the face and heart with something that you really, really fucking admire. And they've absolutely nailed it. That's the kind of cider that I would want to drink. I didn't expect it to be as good as it is.
Me neither.
Because you don't want to hope. Do you know what I mean? Like, you.
Well, yeah, and also for me, because I brought this over to the UK without trying it, which is kind of what I have to do with almost all of their ciders, because for them to send it over, for me to then try it, by the time I've done that, it's all gone, you know. So yeah. I'm a massive fan of their Albie Hill. It's a cider that will always be close to me. It changed my life. It made me decide to do what I want to do in cider. And I thought, this nothing's going to beat that. And then I tried this and I was like, okay, so they're good at other ones as well. And just
as a string in your bow, in terms of ease, it's so different from Albie as well. Like, it's we're talking about the fruit and everything, but it's not like cider makers are closer to like Belgian breweries than they are like craft brewers, I think, in that they have like one thing they do really well and they'll make a little version change to it, and that's really good just by the seasonal nature of the fruit and their process and the time it takes. And like she was saying, then it's like 14 harvests, like that's all it is really, whereas 14 different brews is pretty much a couple months in a brewery. Yeah. But to have something so drastically different to the other ones I've tried, but still have that sort of signature quality, and clearly the view that they've got of cider making is so intrinsically on show here. It's just like, fucking hell.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, that is it. I think that sums it up. Fucking hell.
I'd give it 3 out of 5. It is a solid...
Oh, come on. 2.5. 2.5.
Now that, fucking hell.
As you can tell, everybody, we are slightly enamored with this cider. If you have the opportunity to get your hands on a bottle of Derrida, then you very much should. Grant, what's the best place for people to buy this cider in the UK?
I think currently Scratting's, but we'll put it in the show notes, right? Scott, nod your head. Tell me I'm doing the right thing. Yeah. Yep. Okay.
Amazing.
Because after this, obviously everyone is going to stock it, but I've only got about 3 cases left.
So. Yeah.
Also, when it comes out, it's like, where's the best place to get it? And we'll edit it. Well, it's probably best nowhere.
I know. Websites won't even exist.
That's because Martin will have bought all those 3 cases that he's not allowed to buy.
Jesus Christ. It's a stunner, isn't it?
There we go.
Like, I know.
We were, as you can tell, we're all slightly lost for words. A spectacular cider, Derrida, from Eve's Cidery, 100% wild harvested apples, native yeast fermentation. It's got a little bit of everything, and it's super special. Grant, out of interest, what would the average recommended, you know, retail price on that be? What would a retailer normally be putting that up at?
Let me check my price list, Gabe.
It's about 15 quid, isn't it?
So that I'd sell it at 9 quid.
Get the fuck out.
So yeah, it's nine quid from me. So
so that's 18 quid usually in a bottle shop.
Is that what the market would be?
Yeah, 40% GP is like usual bottle shop prices.
15, right?
So no, if you double it, so I said 15, but if you were to, it depends. If you're like treating cider like beer, you'd usually do 40% GP.
Right.
Okay.
So just double the cost price.
Right.
Wow. Well, I mean, yeah, it's worth every penny of that. That's amazing. That's amazing. Bravo. Well, look, you've got 3 cases of it.
I think I've only got 3. I mean, I only got, that's 12 cases of 12. They do 12. So I only got like 6 or 7. They did a really small run of it.
It says they've got 50 cases are made. That's it. So
Yeah, exactly.
Well, then an amazing and massive thank you to you. Like that's, this is a really cool thing about cider is that this year, for the very first time, ciders are being released in bottles. I think I might mention this before, that if one isn't sort of slightly on the case, we'll miss it. And it will be that one-off, that, you know, that unique vintage, that unique batch, that unique barrel. And, you know, it's introducing that modicum of the hype. Like, you don't want to miss out. But unlike with beer, like with a lot of the beers where we're like, I want to be first in queue to be the first person to try it so I can then go on Untappd and not talk to anybody actually in real life, just tap it into the computer. This is about just having the opportunity to experience this snapshot of that amazing experience. So genuinely, thank you very much, Grant, for doing this.
Thank you.
Well, Gabe, the thank you ends up with you, really, because you turned me on to Eve's. You brought back that bottle, famous bottle of Arley Hill.
Yes.
I still got that bottle next to my fireplace.
The thanks come back to me as well. You're welcome, guys.
I think the thanks are very much from Scott, who is obviously the one of us who is not drinking this right now. So
sorry, Scott.
Fuck. So now it's time for listeners' questions. Every week, we put the call out to see what the most pertinent and, you know, pressing questions in the world of cider drinkers are for 3 people who like to talk about it, who aren't necessarily experts and know all the answers, but we'll give it a good try. First up, we have Mr. James Waddington from Crafty Nectar, a fantastic cider distributor and a collaborative cider maker. He asks, how do we attract a new generation of drinkers in the 18 to 30 bracket? Well, I suppose, you know, for me, part of it comes down to, you know, it could be seen as slightly frivolous, but cider's got to look good to start with. You know, certainly we've got it here with the cider we've been trying this evening, the Derrida, to have a really bold and different and idiosyncratic and eye-catching label. It's got to be certainly moving on from tractors and pictures of apples, et cetera, to trying to tell a bit more of an attractive story, but also in the packaging type. 500 mil beer bottles, crown cap is tells the same kind of story, mixing things up with different shapes and different volume sizes, maybe even into cans, et cetera. Just trying to appeal to those consumers who like nice, bright, shiny things. What do you think, chaps?
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. Basically, I guess it's again looking at the craft beer movement that happened. Was a lot of that was down to packaging, and it still is now with beers. Make yourself stand out from everyone else, and you'll attract a crowd, and you know, obviously the product inside has to be good as well. But I think maybe not going straight to something like the Derrida that we tried tonight, that might be a little bit extreme, a little bit complex for people. Brands like Pulped, for instance, you know them well, Gabe, making ciders that are high quality but are packaged in a way that are recognizable to people.
I suppose a bit like the Scully as well, that we've tried previously as well. Just bright, vivacious packaging, but not to say that the liquid can't stand up. Of course, it has to be good, and from that's a quality perspective and different kind of flavor profile perspective. But you know, you've got to, what's the old phrase? You can polish a turd, but it's still a turd. We don't want to have any turds, do we? So, Martin, you were a beer shit. Now you're a cider shit. What's your take on this and how to attract to this demographic?
It's a funny one, because it just seems like just chasing something for the reason of like, how do we get this? It's like, well, they'll come to it if they fucking want it. Like, you can't make people want a thing. I've tried it, and as soon as you give them samples and stuff, and it's like, ah, this is like wine, this is like beer or whatever, some people just really gravitate towards it, and they find something in it that they can't get from the others. But you can't see the forest for the trees when you're constantly in comparison mode. So I would say they'll come to it when they want to drink it. And the best way to do it is for us to drink good cider maker's cider and promote it with enthusiasm and enjoy it. And if people look at that and go, oh, I want some of that, that's great. Like, that's how I do it. And that's how I've been doing it. And I think we've got enough good cider makers, especially in the UK, that you don't need to change it. And we're talking about the labels. There's so many makers now who are up at that level. We're not 4 years ago where they're all crap and there's like one label that's good. It's like, there's loads of great stuff now. So there's no excuse. When they're ready, they're ready. Just got to keep drinking it.
Keep drinking. We're trying to get people who aren't drinking it in.
Yeah, but like I say, they'll look at it and go, like with craft beer, you don't go up to everyone who's got Carling and go like, drink my fucking beer. It's like, if they'll look and go, oh, my mate's having a really good time drinking that. And then they try what their mate's having. And all you got to do is just keep drinking cider you like. And people go, oh, my mate loves that cider. There must be something to it, and find it through that.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really good point. And it's something that I always thought when I was in the band, it was, you know, how do you get to this point of success or some kind of tangible a profile that you're happy with? And we always just, but we our success came off the back of word of mouth. And I think that's exactly what you're saying. It's just, okay, well, we'll go and play a show to 5 people. Next time we play a show in that city, maybe there'll be 10 people there. And then maybe the next time we go, there'll be 40 people. And that's, you know, probably the same with a cider, where it's going to take people like us just
just sharing it with pals and saying, here, have you tried this? And not necessarily going, have you tried this because it's got a lovely label and it tastes like this and it tastes like that and it's made here and it's got all these intricacies to it.
Bells and whistles.
Yeah, or do you just go, here, try that. Do you like it? Yeah, good. Next time you go at the shop, maybe you'll buy one. So yeah, that's a very good point.
Well, it comes down to, it's like, how do you get the, what is it, 18 to 30 year olds, was it?
Yes.
How do you get 18 to 30 year olds into cider? You just get them listening to podcasts, mate. That's the back door in. We're,
or TikTok, as Scott keeps suggesting.
Or as producer Scott keeps saying, just get him on, just get the TikTok influencers on the case, which, do you know
the cider dance.
He's probably not wrong. If we created a cider dance, I think Martin's...
That's already a dance, Martin.
That's the harvest floss.
That's good.
Yeah, yeah. But mine, I had an apple in between my ass cheeks. Fucking
moving on to the next question, ladies and gentlemen. We've got Vessel Beer Shop down in Plymouth. They have asked, was 2020 and now 2021 going to be the year that Craft Keg made its mark? For those of you, Craft Keg, it really isn't much of a term. It's something that I have used to quite simply talk about ciders made from smaller, interesting producers that kind of only in the last year or two have been experimenting by actually placing their ciders into keg, whether it be sort of pasteurized and carbonated or whether it be like an in keg carbonation. The likes of Little Pomona, Ross and Y, Nightingales, Kentish Pip, Hallett's, there's quite a number, and Oliver's as well, there's quite a number of cider makers who are who are in a bit of a pause hiatus here because of the challenges in pubs. I'm still a big exponent of Craft Keg, because for all of the fantastic and spectacular bottles of Derrida like we've had this evening, partly because there's only three cases of it in the world, or certainly in England, you know, the opportunity for big reach for these kinds of ciders, high on experience, low on volume. So I do think that Craft Keg for me is something that is going to have a really important part to play in this sort of, you know, renaissance or the resurgence of awesome ciders, just because of the volume that you can get, the number of consumers that you can reach, but also for a lot of drinkers who are either current cider drinkers and who want to trade up, or who are beer drinkers and want to trade across to drinking a pint. It's a pack format, and it's a place and a time and an occasion and a mode of consumption that they get. 750 ml bottle might not do that. So personally, I'm a big fan, and I was tipping 2020 to be the year of the craft keg. Maybe 2021 will be the case. Martin, as somebody who indeed pulls pints most days of the week, what do you think?
No. I hate to be...
Well, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. That was the Neutral Cider Hotel. Yeah. Good night.
I love them genuinely, and everyone that's making them is making ciders that I want to drink. The problem is cost and turnover. So if you're a pub and you're not selling the equivalent of 52 pints or the two-thirds thereof multiplied... It's going to sit there. And if you're line cleaning in between that keg being on every week and you clean and waste 5 weeks worth of cider that's in the line, and you're pouring samples and people don't go for it, I think those kind of products actually fail. And half of the cider's big problem is that it was linked to pubs in a weird way, where big breweries would buy cider makers and use them as like a sort of retail on tap front. So they would go into pubs and be like, we're going to put your taps in for you. We've got all these lagers and we've got these two ciders now. And it became kind of like a pint format in itself. And the ciders that I like are almost a reaction to that. And they're saying that it can be something more. And I think it says that as well in its pack format. So when it isn't a 750 ml bottle, it says, I'm not a fucking pint. I'm something different. I'm something more and I'm something bigger. So when it then goes back into a pint, it's like there's a kind of an immediate confusion because you're returning to what you get from. And if just to hammer it home, it's like when a lot of people drank craft beer. They came to craft beer as like a getaway breakaway from mainstream lagers, and all the small breweries that were making craft beer didn't make a lager. So people just suddenly got to the point of like, lager's crap. But the reason these breweries didn't make lagers is because they're too expensive and too time consuming. So if you've got tanks set aside in your brewery and you're paying square footage for a year, if you can't turn over that tank quick enough to pay for it, you wouldn't make it. So it's not that these craft breweries don't like lager or lager's bad, it's that they couldn't do that. So it's like, why are we going back to keg? I get it for the outreach, but I think it's better in bottles. That's my opinion.
What do you think, Grant?
I've purchased kegs from my suppliers. They're still sitting in my lockup. That's partly due to the current situation with the COVID, but also, you know, I've had bar managers actually say to me that, you know, the taps are like the inner sanctum. You know, you need to work to get to that, and when you're talking about an individual consumer, convincing them to pay, you know, between £10 and £20 for a 750ml bottle of cider, if you've got someone there that's knowledgeable enough and passionate enough about that to explain why they should pay that, they'll I think they're more willing to take a risk on that than what, £6 plus pint in a bar. And especially, like Martin says, what they'll do is they'll go, well, can I taste it? And you're not going to say no because you're hoping that they're going to buy a pint or a schooner or a third, you know, whatever it is, a half pint. Then if they try it and they're like, well, that's not what I thought it was. Because they're not expecting a complex cider, they'll move on. And and everyone's getting really excited about kegs and cider just now and keg conditioning, and that's brilliant. But it's not an easy sell, and it's not like I don't think it's a great way to bring people in. I think once it's slightly more established, it'll be great and people will get excited about it. I just think it's a bit premature.
Well, we're talking about pints as like a measurement, they're kind of, it sounds silly, but it's that element of just finishing the day, having a pint, sitting down, and the ceremony is in unwinding with a pint with your mates. But what's good about with cider and 750ml bottles is it is like a little sort of celebration in itself there, and you're elevating the product rather than returning to a pack format that kind of degrades it just by the nature of barmen and bartenders not treating it correctly, kind of thing. I just think if I was going to try something, as example, the ciders I like I had Mayflower from Oliver's tonight, I wouldn't pay £6 for a third of that so that they could pay the duty to get the keg. Do you know what I mean? It just feels like of all the cost to get there, I think it definitely suits a single serve, one-off bottle that you can almost upsell, talk about, and present to the customer as like, you're going to try this. This is the full package.
Yep.
I mean, you're wrong, but that's absolutely fine. Sorry. Joke. I think, you know, it's really important to remember for everybody, for me constantly, and for anybody who's listening, that cider is a fruit fermentation. It's made more like wine and less like a beer. So the principles of how you pack it and how it dispense it are naturally predisposed to be in a similar alignment, and actually the more of the mode, the presentation, and as you described about, you know, in terms of the, you know, the lager and the time and the cost that it takes to make a product, to get that into a keg, you know, that's obviously either particularly tight on margin for the producer, or potentially they've made some, you know, they've made some sacrifice in terms of the quality of the liquid in some way. So the environment and the opportunity and the place for craft keg ciders in the UK is tight and it's tough, and time will tell as to whether it has an impact and makes its mark. For our final question this evening, Martin, what have we got?
Going over to me. So, DNash24. So, D_Nash24 on our Instagram. That's at Neutral Cider. That's at Neutral Cider Hotel.
How many ciders have you had this evening, Martin?
Fuck it, too many. I've been drinking all day, man.
You
I can't see.
Your eyes are slowly getting narrower and narrower by the looks of it.
His name's actually, it just says David. I've just read that all wrong. No, it says D_Nash224. He says, hey, what advice would you give to beginners on blending apple varieties?
Ooh.
And I'm not sure if that's in does he mean like blending single varieties together in barrel, or like blending in, like growing?
I don't know, Martin, is this your question or his question?
Is your name actually Dean Nash? No, you're 24.
I'm trying to look at his 24. Page to see if he's a...
I mean, I guess, is he asking what would you look for in a blend? Or is he asking you for you to specifically give him a recipe?
Well, he's a beginner, so he's saying, like, what varieties would go together? Like, what would bring out what in each other kind of thing?
Well, the advice I always give is, if there's the opportunity, if you have the inclination and the amount of fruit, is if you're early in your cider making journey, undertake a fermentation as a single varietal, so that you just get to understand what are the different flavor and other sensory sort of characters of that apple variety. So you know that Tremlett's Bitter has this really intense punchy bitterness, that Yarlington Mill has the, you know, the big, rich, smooth astringency, that Foxwell is this really intense, insane sherbety, acidity, etc. Once you get to know what the individual apples do, then that gives you the opportunity to put different apple varieties like into the mill, into the scratter. So you sort of press them together, knowing what flavor profiles you're going to get. The other process, of course, is that you undertake and then all blending post-fermentation to get your different kind of flavor profiles. But understanding what your apples are going to give, I think, is kind of like the key place to start in all this.
Which I think comes back to what I said at the start, when I was drinking a single variety Rosso, and why I bought this mixed case by them purely to go through and taste it and take notes on what these single varieties tasted like. So if you're someone who's looking to start making cider, commercially or for personal reasons, then you're looking to blend, I think the best thing you could possibly do is taste, find as many single varieties as you can. I understand there's going to be different, you know, it's going to be terroir, there's going to be all these different elements that come into play when someone else is making it, but there's no better way than tasting single variety ciders to know how they act and how they end up when they're fermented.
Or you could just do what Autumn and Ezra did and just scrump whatever there is in a field and make gold.
This is it. You know, so often you make the cider that you is provided to you. So for any kind of cider or perry I make, it's normally I go to the orchard that I'm able to go to, the fruit that's available, that is ripe. That's what I pick, and that's what I make. In the ideal scenario, maybe you would separate out all your fermenters and you could do different trials and iterations and different things. But sometimes it's a case of, we've got these apples, we've got this blend, this is what we're going to make this year. And, you know, sometimes that's okay. And it's just about celebrating what you got, the fact that you can be out in those orchards and picking that fruit, that you can be making, you know, cider in your cellar or in your shed or wherever it may be. Anywhere you can, it's got to be a good thing. Just keep trying. You've got to start. That's the hard thing. I'm a bit of a perfectionist, and it took me a while to like make my first cider because I was so scared it was going to go wrong. But like everything in life, you learn so much from your mistakes. So just give it a try, learn, and you know, clean the drains with it if you have to. I'm sure it'll come into use somewhere. And
it's the next book called Lifeology.
It is. That's right. top 100 just tips from my life as a ciderologist.
Search for the hero inside yourself.
That's right. And other M people songs. So that wraps up our question session for this week. As ever, or not as ever, as of now, you can find Neutral Cider Hotel via social media channels. I have obviously forgotten what those social media channels are. It's at Neutral Cider Pod on Twitter. And Neutral Cider Hotel on Instagram. Find us, talk to us, and we will talk to you back as well, possibly, because we're nice people. And so, but keep the questions coming in, and you know what? We can even branch it out. Doesn't even have to be cider questions. We are your agony aunts. We are here to help you on life's journey. And you know, we're moving on up from now
casual,
on.
Just a casual. How are you doing, guys? Like, how are you feeling? That'll do. That'll be all right.
There we go. Or we have had a last minute question coming in, which is how much time each day do you spend curling your moustache? Well, I'm not going to answer Grant. That question, producer Scott, because your terrible American English has missed out the O in moustache. So, you know, I'm not going to answer that question. So
I must ask you a question, but I'm an American cunt.
Unfortunately, he does not have the opportunity to respond to that, so it'd be unfair to answer that.
Are you going
to
cry about a little bitch boy? That's going to be the start of the show now. You're going to cry about that little bitch boy?
Everything you've said is the possibility of being at the start of the show, Martin.
Please drink two bottles of very highly alcoholic cider before every time we do a show. In fact, we probably all should. It would make for a considerably better listening.
No, my chest is on fire. Holy shit. Oh, God. Drink responsibly.
And on that bombshell, ladies and gentlemen, thank you once again for listening to another episode of the Neutral Cider Hotel. We've had a great time. We've had some fantastic ciders. It's now time to go and seek some medical advice. We bid you fond farewell. Checking out of the hotel. Come and visit us again. Cheers. Or wassail. Or face. Bye.
Face.